Hi, this is Tom Rhodes. Please join me as I scour the four corners of the earth to bring you interesting and intelligent funny people who will enrich your life with wisdom and laughter. I'll take you to Europe, Australia, all over America. I might take you to the peaks of Machu Picchu, the canals of Amsterdam, the Great Wall of China, or the swamps of Florida, and certainly the many, many comedy clubs and comedy theaters all over the world. Come hang out with me and meet the many interesting people that pop up in my life as I travel the world as a stand-up comedian.
You're listening to Tom Rhodes Radio.
Karate kick, baby.
Rock and roll.
Welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. This episode was recorded 2 months ago when I was performing at Zany's in Chicago. I worked with a young guy named Drew Michael. And you know, I love comedy. I'm a fan. It's what keeps me going. And every once in a while, as a headliner, you see a young comedian who's got the spark. He's just got funny material, and you know he's going to develop into be a great comedian one day. And that's the way I felt about Drew Michael. This is an interesting recording because we only had time to record on the Saturday night between shows. It was a three-show Saturday, so it's interesting the way the conversations are broken up into three parts, and we're commenting and talking about the shows that just transpired. Before we get started, I want to give a special shout-out to Matt in San Diego. I love getting messages and emails from people. I don't have any commercials in my podcast. I don't make any money off of it. It's purely a labor of love. So when I get messages from people telling me how much my podcast means to them, it's fuel for my fire, to be honest with you. It keeps me motoring down the highway. And since I don't have any commercials, you know, you can support me by seeing me live. I'm doing a big show November 30th. That's the Saturday after Thanksgiving in Austin, Texas at the Stateside Theater. And I've asked seven of my favorite local Austin comedians to open the show. If you're in Texas or live in Austin, please come out. I'm going to record the show. Hopefully, it'll be a live episode of my podcast one day. But it's going to be epic and historic, and I would love for the place to be packed. So I'm bringing you now a lovely guy who I think's got a big future in this business, unless he seriously fucks it up. Please welcome and open your hearts for the one and only Drew Michael. Drew Michael, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, Drew Michael.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So, what do you think you did wrong that first show?
That's an old classic comedy line.
What's that?
What do you think went wrong?
No, but you came off. I was like, dude, great set. And you're like, and you're
saying.
You've destroyed every show. And I only caught the last half.
Right, right.
Of this one. It seemed like you had them.
No, it was good.
It was
good.
A palm of your hand. And you go, I see a guy destroying and gets off. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were giving me the old, you know, when someone gets off stage and then the person waiting to go up next is like, where do you think you lost them? You know, I thought you were giving me
the worst thing comedians used to do, like the young comedians, like when they'd be there, they'd bring their girlfriend to the show, like right as they're going on, as they're being introduced, the older comedian would go, hey, I'll talk to you, girl, while you're on. That was the real evil one.
Okay.
The guys on stage.
I like that one. That's a good one. No, I'm weird. I get I can have everything go perfectly, but if there's a line that I like a lot and it doesn't get what I think it deserves, I could hate the whole crowd just for that. And I've gotten better at it. I used to.
Which line specifically?
I don't know. I can't
remember. Do you feel that strongly about it? You would turn on an audience.
I don't know. I couldn't even tell you. But I just know that when something doesn't connect, it kind of indicates that they don't really get what I think I'm about. And then that could sort of taint the whole thing. So maybe that happened. I don't know. I just thought, the set was good.
I think it's been exciting watching you work all week because, I was talking about it last night. You know, it's this exciting moment when it starts to gel for a comedian. Mm-hmm. And then when a guy gets stage confidence and it's just like hitting hyperspace. And, you know, your material's really tight. I thought it was much more a looser rant. at the beginning of the week, and then as I've watched you every night, I see that there is structure
to it.
It's not just like, you know, this angry rant.
Well, in, the weekday shows, I'm probably looser, just seeing if I can come up with new stuff, so I keep it looser. And then the weekends, I mean, you know, you tighten it up and really stick to the lines that work.
But I love your jokes are dark and twisted, and I don't think you should change a word of it.
Good. It's always, I always have a hard time when people say, and I don't mean to sound like an asshole, but like, if someone says something nice to me, I'm bad at, like, I don't know what to say back. Thanks.
Hey, no,
you
it's
know
cool.
What I mean, I don't mean like I'm.
No, grateful. But I was talking like I love the Hitler line. You know, you're Jewish,
right?
And you say that when people, you know, all hate somebody, you find a way to like them, or however
right.
you set it up, and it's great. It's I think it's hilarious for a Jewish guy to stand there and defend Hitler. I mean, I think I love sucker punch jokes, and you don't see where the punchline's coming from.
Right. Yeah. I guess if that's the one I can get away with, maybe. Even though, you know, because, you know, black comics can get away with saying certain things. I guess this is the one thing. This is my N-word, I guess. I can say this, and no one will be like, hey, that's offensive. To who? To me? I'm fine with it. It's okay.
Do you are you pretty dark and twisted guy in real life, or
I don't know.
Going
I mean,
to a mall and shooting it up.
It's I mean, it's not unnatural. Like I think my head just goes to that place, and my sense of humor is definitely dark. I know, like, just the things I find funny are the fucked up things, the things that are like, you know. I had such a good example of this the other day. I can't remember. I'm so mad. There was something that made me laugh that wasn't even a joke. It was just something that was totally fucked. I don't know. I was writing. I was coming up with an idea for my buddy and I were writing a movie. Not really, but like we were just talking about doing a movie called a Holocaust movie, but not like the Schindler's List pianist variety. Like you do it like a zombie movie, but the zombies are just regular Jews, and so everyone just starts blowing their heads off, and they're like, "Oh my God, they're everywhere!" But it's just the Jews eating. Like, I pass the salt, and he's no.
Did you see that Sarah Silverman episode where her and her friend were battling to see who had the more spectacular Holocaust memorial?
Oh, no.
And hers
no,
was
that's
like
funny,
Holocaust-orama or something.
She okay. No, that's funny. That's super funny. No, I didn't see that. But that's the thing. It's like, you know, the reason that I talk about stuff like that, I think, or I like to bring it to the stage, is like, or the reason that I like to just think about that in general is because, like I say in the Hitler bit, it's like, when everybody has this just sort of uniform, homogenous opinion about something, it's no longer even being questioned. And I'm not saying that's the wrong opinion to have, but it's just become this reference point where Hitler is evil and you can't really deviate from that. There's no wiggle room. That's just the way that it is. And that just sounds like brainwashing to me. So I don't necessarily think he was a good dude or he did good things. I don't really know enough to...
You're saying he might have had a good day?
Yeah, right. Well, I'm just saying, like, I don't think any of us really know enough to make that judgment. You know, we're hearing, like, sound bites. We're hearing... You see numbers and you see the monstrosities and you go, well, clearly that was a bad guy. But it's like, what... I don't know where... What makes him bad...
I hate when they compare, you know, like, world leaders. He's the new Hitler. Like, Saddam Hussein was the new Hitler. And mm-hmm. then Gaddafi. It's whenever we want to attack somebody. It's, the new Hitler.
Right. Yeah, yeah. He's a reference point. And he's no longer a person anymore or even a leader. He's a reference point. It's the same with anything like that. You know, the N-word, rape. These are all things that have now been...
Buzzwords.
Yeah, they're no longer the things that they mean. They now are this cultural phenomenon, and to me, I don't respect that notion when something is so big that it becomes it's like a celebrity in itself. You know what I mean? Like the N-word is a celebrity. So, you know, we make fun of celebrities, we pick them apart, but It's a strange thing when the word is more famous than what it actually stands for.
Right.
You know, or like rape, people get up and up tight about rape jokes, and like now you just see rape, you know, this rape joke and Daniel Tosh and blah, 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 blah. And now rape, it doesn't even mean unconsensual
sex. Did people just hear the word
anymore.
And they're turned off?
Yeah, it means that whole hysteria. And I never liked that, so I always I'm the person to pop that bubble.
Well, a lot of your humor is like pointing out inconsistencies in society and technology. And what are some of your strongest convictions?
I honestly feel like convictions, like, it's my convictions are all primitive, right? It starts like with the thought process rather than like a belief. Some people have conviction in, say, you know, like God or, you know, democracy or a certain politician or a baseball team. I don't know. But mine, it's more internal. It's more about like the way to go about life, being honest, question everything. You know, I'm skeptical. I'm also inquisitive, curious, you know, that kind of thing. I think honesty is the biggest one. And honesty from you, like, you should be your own harshest critic. You should be calling yourself out on all the shit that you could. That way nobody else can do it to you. You know what I mean? And that if everyone did that to the best of their ability, I think we'd be better off. Okay. Just truly honest with myself. Hey, like, what am I doing? What are we doing? What are we, you know, if I do this, what does that mean to the rest of the world? And it's not just being more conscious, it's just like truly understanding what...
Policing yourself.
Yeah. And then so someone can't go, hey, you're a hypocrite because this and this and this. And you could be like, no, I am aware of that, but here's the explanation. Right. You know, I don't know.
Not a big fan of politics. I don't know why people still take politics seriously, like politicians. It's like literally 100% of them are full of shit. 100% of them. They just keep, you know, I'm going to do whatever I got. No, shut the fuck up. This is all a farce. Stop taking them seriously, and then they do something different than what they promised, and people are like, what the fuck? He didn't do what he said. Yeah, he lied. Those are just commercials to get you to buy the product that's him. That's all it is. To get mad at other commercials when their products don't live up to the hype that they've created in the 30-second spot. To email Bud Light angrily, like, dear Bud Light, I drank your beer every night last week. Didn't fuck one hot bartender. Like... If they showed what actually happens when you drink beer, you would never buy the beer in the first place. They showed a commercial of some dude getting tossed from a 4 a.m. bar and then dragging a sack of Taco Bell back to his one-bedroom apartment, then plopping down on his futon, jerking off into his boxers, then waking up in the morning, eating the gordita for breakfast, and Bud Light. You're not going to buy that beer. You're going to be like, oh, shit, that's what happens. I'm going to drink juice and go to bed early because I don't want to be that guy. It's the same shit. People get so invested in things that they can identify with. You know, they let them identify with powerful organizations. Sports is like that. Sports gives people an outlet to connect to something powerful so they can achieve something without actually doing shit. Yeah, we won. No, you sat on your fucking couch and ate chicken wings. You didn't do shit. You're not on the team. That's the thing. You're not... You know what I mean? Like, let's enjoy sports. It's entertainment, but you're not on the team. It doesn't matter. Like, when you care that much about something that's not you, like, if you care that much about Star Wars, you're a dork. Everyone calls you a dork. But why don't we call them sports dorks? They do the same shit as a Star Wars dork. They'll go to the game dressed up like the people that they're going to watch. How is that different than a Jar Jar Binks costume? It's not. It's the same. To walk into a place like, hey, look at me, I'm Soriano. I said, no, you're not. You're somebody who gave up on life like 12 years ago, and now you're living vicariously through this dude who's richer than you, and you're wearing his work clothes. That's weird. It's weird as shit. You have his work uniform on. What's weirder than going into a man's business already donning his uniform? You ever walk into a Best Buy wearing a blue Kyle shirt? You ever do that shit? Hey, Kyle, I got your clothes on. He'd be like, who the fuck are you? You need to leave. I don't know where you got that, but that's weird. No, I'm not going to sign it. You got to go.
Well, what irritates you the most about yourself and modern living?
Oh, Jesus. The thing is, I don't dislike myself. I wish I could see myself how others saw me. Like, I wish I could see myself as a stranger, because I feel like I would, you know, I have a hard time taking other people's opinions.
Well, her. That girl did leave on the comment card the first night, I want to have sex with the Jewish guy.
Yeah, that's like, I mean...
that might be a good hint at outside perspective.
Oh, right, yeah, but right. But then, the narcissist...
I wonder how people see me. Girls writing on a, please call.
Right. I believe me, the narcissist in me wants to just selectively listen to those people, the people who like me, but, you know, it's across the board. And I think... One of the things I don't like about myself is my inability to see, to not be solipsistic about it, to not see outside myself and, you know, not think that my viewpoint is the only viewpoint. Just because it's a destructive mentality, it doesn't help. Because it's not, I know it's, like, logically, it's not true. I'm not, like, the center of the universe. Like, I know that logically, but emotionally it feels like I am.
Right, but a lot of people do want to argue their belief systems. People are very argumentative about... defending their beliefs and
what right, yeah, right. Well, that's so. Because they've structured their entire identity around these concrete beliefs. You know, they think, you know, we do it all the time. We say, okay, gravity, that's a given, so we build our life around gravity. And that's a safe bet because it's been proven when people build their life around even something as silly as like a politician, like, oh, this is the guy, this is my you know, icon, this is what I'm investing my identity into, or like the gay rights movement, or just any something. Then if you challenge the belief, you're now challenging the core of their identity. So they get very protective of that because that's like what's in them. That's like their skeleton, and you're like poking at it. They're like, hey, that's if that falls apart, then I'm nothing. I'm just a ball of jelly. So I think that's something – I found that to be the case when people get offended at a joke. It's because you've infiltrated their belief system and are now on the inside wreaking havoc. You know what I mean? If you're up there confidently questioning something they thought was unquestionable.
Right.
Or they thought was certainly true.
That's the point of comedy, though, isn't it?
Yeah, to varying degrees. Some people go, you know, an inch below the surface and kind of, you know... So, like a Seinfeld. Seinfeld applies the same technique as any other comedian, except he applies it to everyday things. You know, pizza and helmets and milk and stuff like that. But if you apply it to religion, politics, you know... human emotion, then people get more personal because it's deeper stuff. It's the same technique, though. You're just applying it differently.
What irritates you the most about modern living?
Everybody. I don't know, but see, that's the only thing. I wish I
love your style on stage. It's just a guy who's just perplexed and irritated with the world, and it's like...
Yeah, I have no answers, too. I really...
And you don't act like you do, which is great. You're not like a preachy comedian.
No.
It's not like, we should be doing this kind of thing. It's like, you know, we're fucked, I'm personally fucked, the world is fucked, and,
yeah,
you know,
and
let's open up some dialogue about it. That's what your act feels like to me.
Yeah, well, it's like, okay, if you had a buddy with, like, a big drug problem, okay... It became a huge...
Nobody wants to talk about it.
Huh?
Nobody wants to talk about it.
That's what I'm saying. And so you and all of his buddies, and you get together and you say, listen, this is a huge problem. You might do like an intervention type thing. You might just bring it up to him. You might just say, hey, look, we're concerned. And the reason you do that is because before he can fix it, he has to accept that it is a problem. Okay? And so I think we need to do the same thing socially. Before we can fix the problems, we need to accept them. You need to understand and accept them. Now people will go out and talk about, like, oh, the problem is, you know, taxes, or the problem is, greedy rich people. It's too simple. That's, like, something you'd see in an hour-and-a-half Hollywood movie, you know. Again, I think it starts with the people. It starts with, like, what's going on within you. I love all these people trying to take a stab at solving, you know, macroeconomics and geopolitics when they can't fix the relationship with their dad. You know,
right.
Why don't you start with, like, what's next to you before you, like, go off on China? So what do you know about it? It's like, we might have been talking about this the other day. I think the human brain is not good enough to come up with a working model of the world. It can barely understand itself, much less a relationship with a family. You know, like, when your family, you kind of understand on a gut level. You just get your family. You can't really articulate it. You just get it. Yeah, but you can't do that with, like, a city. Like, I don't get how Chicago works as a city with the politics and economics and, you know, different divisions and courts. I don't fucking know. you know, you can maybe learn about that, but then you're going to learn how that city interacts with the other cities, and interacts with the state, interacts with the countries, interacts with other countries, interacts, you know, like...
Well, you should go to Asia and Latin America and see how some of those cities are. With,
yeah. Shitholes? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you go to, right, you go to, like, Calcutta, and you're like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Chicago's all right. Yeah. They pick up the trash right. every day. But, you know, like, even, like, silly things. You talking about wanting to get off Facebook and ending the popularity of Facebook. And if you wanted to do that, you would have to start a group page on Facebook.
Right, well, that's just the first thing you'd think of, right? You'd just be like, how do you start a movement of any kind or any kind of organization? It's Facebook. And that's another thing. If you're going to ask me things that irk me, is that every technological advance... We cannot say no to. We've never said no to a technological advance, and that's terrifying. That means technology has a power over us. We cannot say no as a society. Certain people could say, oh, I don't watch TV, or I don't use a cell phone, and blah, 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 but those people are way to the margins. Louis C.K. just did an amazing bit on cell phones, and, like, his girl...
His daughter.
It's amazing. Yeah. And he's, like, he's eating up comedy premises like Pac-Man. Yeah. That guy. But, like, that's... It's the same idea, only to another extent, where it's, like, I think our inability to refuse technological advance, understand what the costs are... You know, iPhone doesn't cost $200. It costs whatever the psychic price is when you stare at it all day... And everybody stares at it all day, and this is not how we're functioning as a society. That stuff's getting in your brain. It's affecting how you think, how you feel. Same with, you know, TV, computers. We're in front of screens more than we're in front of people, and that has a huge effect on everybody. And it's not so much that I think that's bad. I just want us to willingly know what we're doing before we go forward. I don't think
right, because it's going to affect our evolution, our family dynamics, our friends, relations, just... it's this constant distraction.
Yeah, like I was talking to
There's always something better happening on your phone than the person you're talking to.
Exactly. Or I mean, it's the internet. The internet is everything. So you could see, like, your phone, it's everything. You could open it and it's whatever you want it to be. You want to see a live baseball game? You can see that. You want to
see a guy get killed by getting fucked by a horse?
It's anything. Right. You can see a beheading. You can read about cooking. Like, anything you want. Any question you have is there. And
so the sum total of human knowledge
at
your fingertips on the internet.
And I don't have that. You don't have that. So why are we talking? Why don't I just go into my phone and I could... You know,
there's some shit on Wikipedia you could be reading right
now. But see, it sounds nice. You're like, why wouldn't I just spend all the time on my phone? Because it has all the answers, but then you don't realize what it's doing to you. It's turning you into, like...
You need human contact. Autistic. You need someone look you in the eye when you're talking and know that somebody's listening to you.
And right, or maybe not. Maybe we don't need it anymore. Maybe that's been outmoded, you know? Maybe, like, relationships of any kind are no longer necessary, and all relationships will be via email and Facebook.
Did you really once race a girl... And the outcome was a tickle.
You got to tell a kid what love is. That would be tough. I think they should teach kids love in DARE. Like, that's when you should learn about it, because it's a drug. It's a fucked up drug. It's the most fucked up drug. It's more fucked up than any other drug. It's scary. It's dangerous. It's addictive. You can get hurt. Right? I know what happens on drugs. I've done drugs. I've done most of them. Love is crazier than all of them. When you smoke weed, what happens? You giggle on your couch for no reason. Fine. You snort coke, you might start an impromptu face-slapping contest at a bar. You know, whatever. Okay, you eat mushrooms, you're going to watch your own ego dissolve and realize the social constructs are all arbitrary. The idea of possession might trip you out. Like, dude, I own a shirt? Okay. That happens, but love is the only drug that has ever made me think it was a good idea to go apple picking. There's no other drug in the universe that has warped the paradigm enough to get me to skip around an orchard picking apples off of a contrived tree and then shout, hey, let's race to the top of the hill. Loser pays the winner in tickles. Come on. 27. Year old man.
That seems like something that would have happened when you were 12.
That's no.
The loser gets tickled. I'll race you to that bit, fence post.
You're talking about the apple picking bit, and that is, I remember talking to, like, being like in love with a girl and talking to her on the phone, and I was out of town doing a gig, and she was, I was asking what she was doing for the weekend, and she was saying she was gonna go apple picking with her friend. And I remember, like, honestly thinking, like, oh, I wish I could do that. And then I was like, wait, what the fuck? I don't do that. But then I was like, it's very, like, you know, it's a wild thing to be like, oh, I want to go apple picking now. It's like, when? Oh, I don't know. Well, I guess I do that now because I love girls. That was one thing. And the other reference is that we like, read books to her dog.
What?
Yeah, these are two things that I did.
What kind of books were they?
They make books that are, like, in the second person you read to a dog and you explain the day the dog had.
No way.
Yeah, so you're like, it's like a book. It's like, oh, so you went to the park. You've caught the frisbee that I threw at you. You had so much fun. You read it to the dog. I'm dead serious.
Come on. Really?
That's a thing. Not only is that a thing, but I did it. And that's not something I would ever do. But
you, like, when read you're in to the dog.
Yeah, I read. I had to.
Because you wanted the girl's honey pot.
It was when you're like, you're just like this person who'll do nice things, because, or not nice, it's just weird things that you wouldn't necessarily normally do.
Show your sensitivity, lure her in.
I guess. Yeah, we're all like, it was her whole family. We're sitting around, and that was something they did.
She's into fly fishing, you're into fly fishing. She's into reading to a dog, you're into reading to a dog.
Right, that's what I do now. And
this is your current girlfriend?
No, this is an ex. But that was like a function. She had like a good family.
Does she have you read to plants?
Yeah,
we took lots of sunshine.
We play piano to plants. Play songs and sing them to plants. But, like, see, the thing is, I come from such a fucked up family that I don't know what a good family looks like. So she could have shown me anything. I've been like, I guess this is what happy families do. I don't know. I don't have no idea. The same, like, if your first girlfriend's like fucking crazy,
that's you
don't
you know
that.
Right?
Yeah. You just think that's what girls are like. That's all you know. So then, so you think, like, oh, I guess all girls cut themselves. Like, no. That's just, you found that one.
Why do you think your family's fucked up? Just because your parents are divorced?
Well, my parents are both twice divorced. And I don't know. It's just a dynamic of, like, constant yelling at each other. Like we're always yelling at each other.
My family had that.
Yeah, no, I know you do. You are doing the same job as me.
It's great for comedy.
You can't act
if
like
your parents
like,
would have been loving and demonstrative to you, I mean, you wouldn't be a comedian right now.
No, it's very true. It's absolutely true. But like, I like how you were like, that's not so crazy. Mine's the same way. I look at you where you are.
They did you a favor.
In a way, yeah, right.
They gave you the neurosis.
They were nice about it, you know. They weren't shitheads, but they were not good parents or husbands or wives.
Who was funnier, your dad or your mom?
My mom. My
really?
Dad is not funny.
Your
my mom.
Mom
never attracts, or is she never is with funny men.
But she's sharp.
She's funny, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I misheard you. Yeah. She's like goofy. She's like silly and weird. People think she's funny. She's like silly. She's like young at heart, you know, very, very free spirit and creative and stuff like that. She's not like a joke writer.
Right. But she, like, had humor.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, she likes to take credit for all of that. Anytime I do something great, like if I'm doing well in comedy, like she comes out to see, she was at the show last night. Oh, anytime. So when I'm doing decently at stand up, I have moderate success, whatever, for this state. I don't really know, but it's like I'm capable of doing what I'm doing right now. And she always says, like, well, I was the funny one, and you got a sense of humor for me. But anything I do something fucked up, like if I can't hold a relationship or if I'm like, you know, too narcissistic, like, well, that's your father. It's like, well, yeah, okay. Cherry pick all the
right
traits and qualities. Yeah, we can pick up afterward. I got about 10 minutes to get ready.
All right, babe. Thanks.
You bet.
A lot of comedians talk about their problems. That's sort of a common theme in comedy. I'm no different. A lot of comics have similar problems, so sometimes you talk about similar things. I think the audience doesn't understand this all the time. I did a show recently, and I read a Yelp review of the show that I did. It was a really negative review that this woman wrote. She's like, it was terrible. They're all just up there talking about masturbating and porn and not having girlfriends or jobs or money. It was a terrible show. We didn't like it. One bit bad show. It's like, that's not necessarily a bad show. That is a bad life. That's what that is. Just reviewed their life. You gave their life one star. Go fuck yourself. That's not how Yelp works. The same woman probably writes a review for Anne Frank's diary. Like, this girl needs to get out of the attic. Like, seriously. What is she doing up there all day? All day? Bad book. Thumbs down.
Okay, so the first 20 minutes of this podcast was between the first and second show on a three-show Saturday night,
right,
at Zany's in Chicago.
It's a rare thing these days, the three-show.
Three shows are brutal, man. That's old school.
It's very
That's
old
real
school.
Old. And I'm not a fan, and you really got to psych yourself up mentally. When the third time you're saying the jokes, you're like, Jesus, have I already said this? And
oh, right. How are these people laughing at this? This isn't funny.
Right. And by the time you've said it that many times, it loses its freshness.
No, I remember all day today, I was like, okay, today's three shows. Don't burn it all on the first show.
And then it starts at 7. And I always say I didn't write my jokes for the kind of person that would go out at 7 p.m.
Right, when it's so light out, that's no good.
But it's always surprising. So I'm like, that first, I thought that 7 p.m. show tonight was blistering.
Yeah, they're good. Yeah, yeah. No, they can be good. But, right, it is weird to do it at like an early time. Yeah, you're talking. It's somehow, vulgarity seems like it's a nighttime thing. So, like, the sun doesn't mix well with, like...
Comedy, yeah, right, yeah. I like that it's a after-dark activity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now we're back in the green room of Zany's, and it's between the second and third show.
Right,
so
between the 9 and the 11:15.
What do you think went right that show?
I thought they were both good.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. The 9 p.m. Saturday show is the one where I'm probably in the tightest.
That's the easiest show of the week. We both killed.
Right.
It's great. It's my favorite. It's good, sweet.
It's the one you don't fuck around on. You know, you're on a tight schedule. They got to turn it over for the next show. This is like the prime time. You know, everyone's dressed up, whatever. So it's like just, you know, that's not the one to fuck around on, I found. And so.
No, that one's always a champ if you were going to record.
Right, right, yeah, right.
That's the one you want to.
You know, one time I had a show, and at the 9 p.m. was the worst one. They had like 6 bachelorette parties, and they were all heckling.
Mm.
It was a disaster. But most of the time it's usually the.
So you don't do the road or anything, do you?
Of course I do.
You do? Like, oh, yeah. Where do you play on the road?
Everywhere in the Midwest. Any club in the Midwest I played at, except Crackers. I think that's the only club I haven't played. I do Funny Bones, I do Comedy Club on State in Madison, I do Acme, I do the House of Comedy in Minneapolis, I do Skyline in Appleton, Comedy Cafe in Milwaukee.
Cincinnati, Go Bananas?
No, that's the only, Go Bananas and
Lexington
and Crackers
Comedy on Broadway.
What's that?
That's about, I guess that's the Midwestern
the Funny Bone, I'm doing the Funny Bone in Columbus, I do the Funny Bone in St. Louis, Hilarities in Cleveland, in Chicago, Zany's up. Laugh Factory, the Improv, and, you know. So
it seems like comedy's on fire in the United States right now. And then, because I remember in the boom in the late 80s, early 90s, there was like, oh my God, there was like 4 or 5 quality rooms right in Chicago. And there was a big scene here. And then there was like, you know, 5, 6 other clubs in the suburbs.
Right, right.
And there was a lot of Chicago comedians who didn't have to leave Chicago. So now things are blossoming like that again. There's
a
lot of clubs in the city.
It's definitely good. It's better than it was or has been in the last 10, 15 years. But you'll never, never see the kind of shit you saw in the 80s or the kind of shit that happened in the
80s. I don't know, man. I kind of felt it tonight where it's like both shows are packed. It's a cool thing. People are enthusiastic about it.
I think the thing about the comedy boom in the late, like after 79 and into the 80s, the reason it was so crazy is because this is the first time people were allowed to see that other people were thinking the same kind of things publicly.
Yeah, but people weren't as advanced intellectually. I think there was a lot of mediocre shit that was similar and copied and put over and over on television, which is what killed it. I think now people are more into things that are authentic.
Yeah.
And real. And I think they demand that in their comedians.
That right, that's why...
Not a lot of the same similar... I mean, there's, you know, some of the alternative stuff and road stuff is... can fall into similar areas where guys...
For sure. But anyone who's good is going to be genuine and authentic. And this, I mean, they want it not only in the stand-up, but they want, like, a podcast. They want a TV show. They want, like, all these avenues where they can see your voice express itself. Because they want to get closer and closer and closer to you. Not necessarily you, but a person. You know, they want to be involved on Twitter. They want, you know,
right.
be constantly doing everything. You can't just go have a good act for an hour and then have a career anymore. You just can't.
Right.
Like you got, I mean, you know, you're doing the podcast. It's probably something you never would have thought you would have done 30 years ago.
No, but yeah. I mean, it's never been a better time to be a comedian, I say. I talked to Jim Brewer today about this. He's starting his own podcast. And
right.
It's like... It's just like the thing. You can do it. It's whatever artistic vision you want to make it, you know?
Right. Instead of, right, we have all...
And it's like your stand-up. I mean, if you choose to copy other podcasts, that's your decision to your detriment.
A lot of people do the...
You should make your comedy original, your podcast. I mean, I go around the world. I talk to people. I put people I admire for one reason or another on my show.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking me to do it.
And I think you're a comedian that people should know about. I think you're going to, I think you're going to really have a good next 5-10 years.
Oh, man, that would be nice.
As long as you don't become like a fucking heroin addict.
No, it's not my thing.
Sex addict, whatever.
I'm not an addict. I'm an obsessive person, but not an addict. And this is kind of, I've always said comedy is the longest relationship I've ever had.
Yeah, well.
I've been doing comedy over 6 years, and I've never done anything other than maybe like Little League baseball for that long. I've never been with anybody. I've never been in school, like one major that, you know, won anything that long.
It's always comforted me during the difficult periods of life.
Yeah, comedy's weird, man. It's like it's there for you, but it does not give you back what you need in life. It doesn't give you everything. It can't be your true soulmate, you know. It's not gonna be.
I don't know. Everything I ever got out of my life was from comedy. All the a few women that I went out with that didn't see me, but most of them did. What television I've ever done was someone saw me in a comedy club, wrecking the fucking place. A lot of those, one night stands and short relationships with girls through the years were pretty fabulous.
Totally, that's gonna be your life, right? No, I not, and there's no way I'm gonna take that away from you. But maybe I'll phrase it a little bit differently, like almost on a spiritual level, comedy can't, it won't ever give you what I don't know. I think it won't give you everything that you need. It's one thing. It's one dimension of life. It's a huge one, and it seems like it's everything.
Well, I enjoy being around laughter, and comedians are always full of jokes.
Right, yeah, and they're the only people you can say stuff to.
And I don't know, I think comedy's my religion. When it comes down to it, the way I look at it, I think maybe it can be your everything.
Right, where it's like the bedrock of everything else?
Of everything. It's the bedrock of my life. My parents, you talk about your parents' divorce. My parents, my mother was a strong Christian believer. And my father wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have these religious arguments. It just, oh my, they would argue about everything. I mean, and you know, my dad, had some extracurricular activities.
Sure.
And there was tension and arguments. And I remember being a kid and being funny, and then they stop arguing, and then the tension was released.
Oh, okay, so you had one of those experiences.
So, I mean, I think comedy's very powerful.
Right. Hey,
and especially changing people's minds politically and... and then even in the simple, silly way. I mean, like, God, that 9 o'clock show, there was a couple of jokes that just destroyed. And I call it, like, hang time, like in the NFL when, like, they kick the punt. Like, the length of the laugh and the, you know, the height before it starts coming down on the decibels. That's like punt hang time.
Right.
And there was some monster hang time on that 9 o'clock show. It was great.
No, it was. It definitely was. It's interesting that, right, I always say that, like, laughter is, it's, you're communicating, right? So when you do comedy, when you do any sort of art form of any kind, you're sort of putting out a, setting up like a radio signal, you know, similar to how we do it with, like, Into Space. We send out an alien signal, you're like, hey, we're here. And you're basically saying, hey, this is where I'm at. I'm here. I'm on this wavelength. And then when people laugh, they're saying, yeah, we're here too. And so you connect on that, on that one, that one wavelength. And them, to them, the experience is like, laughter is like you surprising yourself that you knew something you didn't know you knew. That make sense? Where it's like, oh, that was in me the whole time.
Right,
I had no idea.
I've had similar feelings.
And you have that, that clash of recognizing that you had, that you surprised yourself by somebody connecting to something in you that you did not know was there, or that you knew was there.
Well, you were a good enough storyteller that you convinced somebody to understand everything you were painting the picture about.
Of course. You have to be talented to put it in a way that they can relate to it, of course. But you're finding an avenue. You're digging a vessel, you know, through the space and time to them, and then you're making it in a way so that they can absorb it and digest it and go, yes, that's the thought. Like, that's the best comedy to me, is when somebody articulates a thought that I've had my whole life and I just never knew it sounded like that.
When did you decide to be a comedian? Were you funny when you were a kid?
Kind of. I was quiet. I'm like half deaf. So, like, I was like fucked up as a kid.
That's real. You're half deaf.
Yeah. Cool. And so I would just be deaf in life, and because I didn't want to, like, I wore hearing aids for like a week when I was 12, and people asked me about it, and I just couldn't deal with it, so I just would rather not hear them. And I would have like little tricks that I would do to fake it, you know, like you could always get away with saying like, yeah, if somebody says something to you, you just go, yeah, you know, most of the time that works. Or you know, I would always, like, when we were riding the car, I'd always run to the front and get, like, call shotgun so I could sit in the front so I could hear the people in the back. Because if I sat in the back, I couldn't hear the people in the front. And I'd be lost. Stuff like that. You know, I look people in the mouth when I talk to them. Like, I don't look them in the eye. I look them in the mouth because I read their lips.
Right.
It's just a natural thing. I would sit in the front in class. And if the teacher turned his back to the backboard, you know, then I couldn't understand a word he said. So I had to, like, wait till he said something that I could understand and then fill it in.
So when did you decide to be a comedian?
I was always, like, I was always into comedy. You know, I remember watching, like, Comedy Central and stuff like that when I was a kid, and always, like, yeah, I think a comic, you always, like, compare yourself to that person. You're like, could I see myself doing that? I think I always did. And then when I was in college, I would get high and, like, write sketches. And then I started doing stand-up when I was, like, 21 or 22.
Where, here in Chicago?
My first time going up was actually at college, at University of Illinois, in Urbana, Champaign.
Oh.
Yeah. That was my first time, and I just did it. It was one of those things where, like, I spent a lot of time building up the courage to talk about it to people, because I felt like that was, like, an official thing. Like, I didn't want to, like, start talking about it and then not do it, so I was like, I'm gonna tell someone I want to do comedy, and then I would be like, you know, not really into school, and so people are like, "What do you want to do?" I'm like, "I think I want to do comedy." I remember saying that I was sitting in my hallway with some girl, and I remember saying that, like, "Okay, I gotta do this now," and I really haven't stopped.
And so, what, for out of college, you moved to Chicago?
Yeah, I dropped out of school, moved back home. I'm from Chicago, so I'm from the burbs, and so I live with my mom for about a year and a half. I waited tables and just drove to the city and did comedy. And then in March of 2008, I moved to the city, transferred my job to downtown, and been ever since. So what is that? Yeah, it's over six, you know, total, it's over about over 6 years.
6 years. I mentioned something to you about alternative rooms versus regular comedy clubs, and you said, but you need both. You need both for the balance. I thought that was a smart...
Yeah, I don't turn away any room. I mean, like, you know, there's... Every room has its picadillos and its nuances and its bullshit points and its good points. You know, I think, yeah, you can't get, like, awesome at comedy without doing the reps and clubs. I don't think that's possible. I think also you can get lazy in clubs because the comedy audiences, sometimes they're not like comedy thinkers, they're just people. So you can get away with comedy tricks that are sort of, you know, level one, level two comedy tricks, as opposed to a more comedy savvy audience has heard all those before, so they need to hear the level six and seven, you know,
navigating. Masterclass.
Exactly. Yeah. You got it.
What do you think makes the Chicago audience unique?
Well, there's not one that's the same. The Zany's audience is going to be different than, you know, the Jokes and Notes audience is going to be different than the Laugh Factory audience is going to be different from the Comedians You Should Know audience is going to be different from the, you know, Chicago Underground audience is going to be different from, I mean, there's a million rooms. There's all the thing that's awesome about Chicago is that the independent scene is as big as the club scene. There are people who never touch the clubs and do well in Chicago.
Right. Bernie Mac never did the clubs here.
Bernie Mac had his own room, right?
Yeah, he had his own. Well, he started his own thing.
So I as of now, I'm a co-producer of a showcase. It's called Comedians You Should Know. It's every Wednesday downtown at a bar called Timothy O'Toole's. Bernie Mac used to run his show at a jazz club downtown at, I don't forget the name of the place, but the address is 622 North Fairbanks. The address of Timothy O'Toole's, 622 North Fairbanks. Our comedy show is in the same room that Bernie Mac used to do his show in. It's a different venue. It's a different owner now.
Well,
yeah, so I always thought that was kind of
cool. So comedy is on fire in Chicago now, and you're going to move to New York.
Yeah. but see, comedy has been so good in Chicago for the past, you know, I feel like I've done a lot to, as much as one person can, to help Chicago be better, you know, with running the show and just being one of the people who's out there doing it, you know, that, you know, encourages other people to do it, or it just raises the bar slightly, and so collectively we've all.
I think it's important for a comedian's development too to move on somewhere for your like university level comedy.
Yeah, you know, I pretty much checked everything off my list in Chicago, and it's time. You know, I'm headlining Zany's in October, and that to me is like, all right, you know, I did that. So I'll come back and do that, you know, as much as I can. But
they've always taken care of their own here.
No, it's been pretty cool. Yeah, no, I think about that, how, you know, they've always put me up, and, you know, I've developed a lot here for sure. Getting those fucking 9 sets in a week is crazy. The Tuesday through Sunday week with the 3 show Saturday.
Yeah.
I don't like doing the 3 show Saturday, but I like that I have to do it. Does that make sense? Like, I like that I'm going through that, because I think it's good for you.
I love it. This lively neighborhood. This place has been here forever. It was like a porno theater.
It was
a strip joint. I mean,
call the Crystal Pistol.
You know, when that day they went, you know, God, titties are so yesteryear. We bring it in some laughter.
Like,
all right, man. We'll do you. We'll keep it rolling.
All right.
Yeah, you're the man. And now it's Sunday in the dressing room.
Oh, man. Yeah. Is this the dressing room?
What do you call it? I guess nobody gets dressed here.
Yeah, this is actually one of the few green rooms that's actually green.
I like it. How was your day, man? It's Sunday? Last day of the week?
It was okay. I don't know. I went to the gym. I came down to the city, had lunch with a friend. Just hung out. I'm kind of burnt out from this week.
Girlfriend, guy friend?
Guy friend.
Okay.
Yeah.
I went to see the Cubs at Wrigley.
Oh, you did? Yeah,
A Hasidic Jewish guy in front of Wrigley holding this, like, kind of palm thing and, like, a fruit that looked like the cousin of a lemon or a lime.
Yeah.
And I talked to him, and he told me...
Sukkot.
That's it. And it's the forgiveness, the holiday of joy.
Yeah,
the last holiday was the holiday of forgiveness.
Right.
The holiday before that was for judgment. So it's judgment, forgiveness, and then joy.
Yeah.
Holiday. And then he let me shake the palm and hold the lime.
I forgot what the palm thing is.
And I said the Jewish prayer.
The lemon, I think it's called a lulav. That's the Hebrew word for that. It's like a wrinkly lemon.
So why weren't you shaking a lemon today?
I didn't fucking know it was that holiday.
You got no.
I just, when you described it, I was like, I think I know that one. I think that's the lemon Sukkot.
The guy was really cool. Mordecai. That was his name. Mordecai.
They're all Mordecai.
And
Mordecai or Solomon.
I'd love to. He let me hold the lime and shake the palm.
Yeah, I'm sure they'd love to call it a lime.
Hey, man, I did it. I did the joy prayer celebration.
It's joyous thing to today. Shake it. It's like a little.
I loved it, man. I feel like spiritually blessed now that it happened.
Yeah.
And that I said in Hebrew, I repeated the stuff that the guy.
Why was he outside Wrigley?
He asked me if I was Jewish. He came up to me and I'm always flattered. I think it's the bald spot. People think I'm I'm Jewish. It kind of is like a luminescent.
Yeah, you got a bald spot. They think your yarmulke flew off.
Right. Exactly.
Supposed to cover that.
I used to be a Jew. I quit. Stop showing up to the meetings. Tape my foreskin back on. Done. That's it. Punched out. Done. Jews are a silly group of people. They've like fucked up ideas of what is like good, like what is celebration worthy. The Jewish holidays. You look at the stories. They have this holiday called Purim. What Purim is, it's a celebration of the time in 400 BC when a guy named Haman tried to murder all the Jews. He failed. Happy Purim. That's the holiday. It's the whole thing. That's it. Hey, we didn't get slaughtered. Here's a fucked up cookie. There you go. Eat that. It's a triangle-shaped cookie because triangle was the shape of Haman's hat. The guy tried to kill us all. Now we're eating a cookie in the shape of his hat. Why not eat a Hitler mustache muffin? Let's do that. Let's throw that in the pastry basket. Then the rabbi will read the story every time he says the name Haman. All the Jews will boo. That's a weak response to attempted genocide. Booing. So I try to erase you from always, and you're going boo. Kind of deterrent is that, you know, to the future generations? Like, hey, you don't want to fuck with us because we'll boo your name and then nibble on your hat cookies. What we're gonna do? Don't think you want to touch that. This is apricot, motherfucker.
So, what is the best laugh you've had lately?
Today, my friend, I was on the phone with my buddy, and he made me laugh very hard. We were talking about another friend of ours who, or somebody he knew, rather. Talking about somebody he knew who has a problem with heroin or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying, like, he didn't know about it until recently. He just thought he was acting strange. He talked about how, like, he was swaying back and forth. He didn't, like, if you don't do these drugs, you don't know what the symptoms are. So then he was saying that, you know, he was sleeping on the street. And then it makes sense now when you go back and think, like, oh, he's on heroin, because when you're on heroin, the street is a giant pillow. And that, for some reason, that to me was was the funniest thing. Just thinking, just picturing somebody.
Like, heroin, like, see, man, like, look at the street,
like, oh, I can sleep on all of it. Yeah. So that.
Okay, that's good. That's good. What was your favorite toy as a child?
Oh, man. I had Nintendo 64 when I was 12. Does that count?
Yeah, what were the games on there?
The first games I played, Wave Race. It was like you were like a wave runner, and you race on the wave runner, and you go through like these obstacles and stuff. GoldenEye, that was a classic. That was like the first really good, like, multiplayer first-person shooter, you know, where you like walk around with the gun and you can play four players.
Like you're in a bank and you can't shoot innocent people, like those.
More like, you have like a mission, so you like go through and try to infiltrate thing and get keys and shoot this guy, and then you can play multiplayer, so it's like four people running around the same map. And then The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, which is still to this day one of the best video games ever made.
What happens in that game?
You know the Zelda series?
I've heard of it, not but I don't
it's
know.
Like they, because it started with like, you know, Nintendo and Game Boy and Super Nintendo and stuff, and this one it's you're essentially a kid, and the princess of some land is captured by this dude, and then like you're not old enough to rescue her, so they freeze you in time for 10 years or 7 years, whatever it is, 7 years, and you come back as an adult, and then you travel back and forth through time. So, because you need certain things that you need to do as a kid, certain things you need to do as an adult, and then you just kind of go and rescue the princess. It's pretty basic.
Cool. You think subliminally that's like your template for life? You're trying to rescue the princess somehow?
In some way. I think that's a common theme, and like, you know, Mario is always...
Well, because I grew up with Mario Donkey Kong, and for me, life is jumping over barrels and trying not to jump on the fireball.
You ever see King of Kong, the documentary?
No.
It's a documentary of, like, the people who, like, are the best players of Donkey Kong.
Cool.
And so, like, there's this one guy who's, like, the god, and then this other dude, just this random dude, kind of just decides to get awesome at this game, and he beats, like, the god of Donkey Kong, and he's, like, super mad, you know?
Wow.
Because he, like, and they show, like, he bought the arcade game, and he has, like, the fucking screen he's drawing on it, like, to show where to jump at each time. Like, you have to, because you have to time it precisely otherwise.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Wow, that sounds
great. The King of Kong, yeah.
King of Kong.
If you like that game, you should watch that documentary.
Are you a big gamer?
No, I guess. I haven't played video games in so long. I played with my 12-year-old cousin recently because I was, like, hanging out with him for the day, and he plays video games. So I was like, all right, we'll play whatever video game you're playing. Let's just play it. And it's I'm like the old man now. I'm like, oh, it's too involved. It's got, like, you know, like, foot pedals and, you know, switches. It's like flying a helicopter. Right. There's all these levers. And I don't know. But when I played it, that's what my parents were saying. It was like, what the hell? You know, I was playing, like, Dreamcast or Nintendo 64. Even that with the joystick and all that, people thought that was nuts.
Yeah.
And now it's, you get the different triggers and, you know, yeah, it's... It's too much. But these kids are, like, awesome at it. That's just because they are used to just pressing buttons and looking at, you know, screens and shit.
What do you think about the influence of technology and the internet on, and just the instant gratification and instant hate telegrams? And I mean, like you talked about, you know, internet stuff in your show, like, but I mean, as a younger person, you're in that,
right?
That, you know, I'm of the older people now.
Right. But you have a...
Your
iPhone.
Skin is still luminescent. I do have an iPhone.
You got the new operating system, so you're using the same stuff I am.
Right, but I mean about kids and younger people.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you talk about it in your act. I mean, it's just obviously it's a big frustration for you that it doesn't seem like...
Yeah, I was talking about
all this technology is going to make us happier people.
Right. I was talking about this today with my friend. Did we talk about this on the earlier section of this show? When I was talking about saying no to technology? Did I mention that? Or did I remember that?
I think. Maybe. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, can I repeat?
Yeah, please.
Just the idea of, like, you know, every... I was thinking about this today. Like, I downloaded the new operating system on the iPhone. It's iOS 7. And... It's okay. I mean, it's better in some ways. It's different.
I hate it. I just updated it 2 days ago. I wish I'd have left the old one.
Yeah, but some of that is, like, you'll get used to it, you know?
Fuck that. I like the everything. Letters, everything were bigger.
Yeah.
They changed where things are a little bit.
It's too monochromatic. Like, it all looks the same color.
Yeah. And it was, like, much more vibrant.
It's confusing
before.
A little bit. Yeah. But regardless, so you get that, and then it slows your phone down a little bit. And then you're like, all right, so I got to get the new phone when that comes out. And then now you're buying the iPhone 6, and then they come out with iOS 8, and then that slows the 6 down. And then you're like, all right, I got to get this. And then you're like, well, I don't want to get any of it. Fuck it, I'll stick with the basic model, and then all your apps don't work. And
right.
So it's like you're kind of – there's this pressure to keep getting the new advancements. And I think that's a good illustration of how it's – difficult to say no as a society to new technological advances. You can't say no to it because you'll be left in the cold. You know, you look like an Amish guy, basically, if you just, like, oh no, I'm gonna stick with, like, a flip phone or the first
right
iPhone.
Man, I remember when I got the Razer phone. That was a pretty cool phone.
Yeah, that was like,
and
the
then after 3 years of having it, I was embarrassed to pull it out in public.
Yep. Yeah,
oh my god, you got a
Motorola
flip phone?
Was like cutting edge stuff, but yeah. Now it's like, you know, man, so, but it's like that in anything. It's like that in business. If you don't use, like, the most cutting edge technology, you're gonna not be as efficient. You're not gonna get
right.
As
but
much
you
done.
Know how Windows kept coming out and people needed it, and then it came out and it wasn't that much of an improvement, and it was clunky. I think now, like, I liked the way the the bright, dazzling icons on this iPhone system before. Now, you're right. It's kind of monochromatic.
Yeah.
That's what things are less dazzling, it looks like.
Yeah, but that's potentially a matter of preference. You know,
it's like the 1976 San Diego Padres uniform. That's what it reminds me of. It's like, really?
That's a really good reference.
This is the best color scheme you could come up with?
Yeah.
Doesn't pop?
That aside, though, the fact that everybody, you know, everybody always wants the newest thing, the best thing, the fastest thing, and I think the question we don't ask is why. Like, what are we chasing? What do we want out of this? You know, and I do think definitely that is, at the very least, disrupting our ability to function, because our brains are still stuck in, you know, I mean, we're the same as we were 1,000 years
ago. When we were hunting and stuff, yeah, we still have the same...
More or less, you know.
I tried to do a bit years ago about that. I think that our eyes and our... because our faces are in screens all the time, that we're going to need our hunting skills less. And that our ears and our noses are going to get smaller and our eyes are going to get bigger.
Oh, okay.
And in the future, we're going to look like aliens. Aliens are us from the future come back to visit ourselves.
Right.
And their heads are really big because they got big brains.
Yeah.
And they got big eyeballs.
Yeah.
From the screens. But like they don't need to, they're not worried about animals killing them, so their ears and their nose have shrunk.
Right. Yeah. So, possibly. We definitely don't need.
I think that might be where we're headed.
That's possible. And the other possibility is like just, yeah, a bunch of autistic children.
But also, yeah.
You know, just like the whole, just...
Well, and the nude, you know, the nude pictures. I mean, there was some before I got married. I mean, I had a, you know, nice collection of photos of girls' pussies from around the continent that texted them to me out of thoughtfulness.
Pussy pictures?
What?
I feel like those are rarer than anything.
Well, yeah, some. And you know, then, like, and tits, then tits would, and
that's pretty common.
Different provocative stuff. I mean,
In fact, the nude pics, the very few nude pictures that I've received from
I read
women.
A thing that they had been trying to protect children from pornography for so long and being exposed to the content, like with the internet and stuff. But the problem people are having now is that kids have the tools to make their own pornography with like their little phones and filming stuff, and that it's like, just like the dangers of being a modern young person.
They can make so much money.
You know, like I'm glad that there wasn't this technology when I was in my early 20s. I mean.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You had, I mean, I don't know what you had, but we had like, scrambled porn on like cable. You know, watch like channels you don't get and it would be like blue.
But those were always like Cinemax.
Yeah, but I didn't have cable, so it was always like you could get that channel, but it would be like scrambled and blue.
Right.
So we'd be like, it would be clear for like a second, where it would just be like, it wouldn't be colored. It would all be in inverted colors, but it wouldn't be static. And that's when you'd like jerk off really hard, and you're like, oh, wait, hold on, stay, okay, and then it would go back to static, and you gotta like, you know, that's how. But yeah, I mean, we'd probably like had printed out pictures of like Pamela Anderson, and now a kid can just, you know, open his iPhone and go, oh, there's this.
I know, I was at an airport a few weeks ago, and the Playboy magazine. My dad had a subscription. I mean, I used to sneak it after
of course.
My brothers, my dad, and I'm, oh my God, these like the just luscious young women. And now I looked at it, I was like, it was like the least thrilling thing. Was like, oh, this is just a picture of a naked woman?
Right, now you
it's
actually,
not a video of her, like, fucking goblin cock.
Right.
And this isn't exciting.
Right, now you're actually looking at it for the articles, because that's truly the most exciting thing in there.
No yeah.
Words. That's weird.
Right.
yeah.
What is the best advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
Doug Stanhope told me. He said, "Impress yourself." That was his advice. Just impress yourself and go from there.
I like it.
I like it too. Yeah, you know the idea of like, if you truly like what you're doing, then who the fuck cares what else? You know what I mean? Because like the thing is, like, if you don't like what you're doing, two things can happen. You could fail, and you'll be like, well, good, I deserve to fail because I don't like this either. Or you could succeed, and then you'll hate yourself even more because everyone will love you for something that you're not. And then you feel pressure to continue being this thing that you aren't. So the only way to really do it is to be you and do the things that you think are cool. And, you know, if people don't like it, fuck them. If they do, then all right, there you go. I think that's... I was telling this story to Vince, the MC this week, about something. I got exposed to something that I think every comedian wishes they could do. I was watching a friend of mine perform, and he did this bit about Michael Jackson. He had this line in it, and it made me die laughing. I was like, holy shit, that is funny. Like, and so after the show, I'm telling him, like, dude, that line at the end of that bit is so fucking good. Like, you got to keep that. That's great. And he looks down for a second, like, thinking, and he looks up at me, and he's like, true, you gave me that line a year ago.
Wow.
And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, I did the bit. And you're like, hey, how about if you said this? And then I did, and then you told me that it's good. And it's like, I completely forgot. I didn't know. I'm not that much of an egotist where I'm like, hey, good, you know, the line that I gave you is fucking the best. I forgot about it. But I saw it. I saw my own writing as an audience member, which is something you never get to see as a comic. You never get to see your bits. Maybe I was saying this to you. Was I talking to you about
this? No, Vince? You didn't say this. This I think it's great.
Yeah, you never get to see your... As an artist, you never get to see your material, your songs, your work as people see them. You know, by the time, you know, Radiohead puts an album out, they've heard that stuff so much where it's like they saw all the steps and the stages and the editing and the...
Right.
It's like garbage to them. But, you know... To me, I hear it fully finished right out of the box, and like I'm like, holy fuck, I can appreciate that on that level. So that was, you know, so comics, I think, always doubt, like, is this funny? Because they've done it 1,000 times. You know, even this week, we've done 8 shows already, and we've done some jokes, I think, every show.
Right.
So it's like, I've done those jokes 1,000 times. It's like, how is this funny to anybody? Because I see through it every single time. It's so predictable. It's predictable to me. There's no surprise. But... when you get to see your writing as an audience member and you forget that you did it.
Right.
I think that was like, and the fact that I really liked that, that made me trust my own instincts more because I was like, oh, I think it's funny. So it goes back to the other thing, trust, you know, impress yourself. And so I just, you know, sort of follow my instincts and hope that, you know, it works out.
Are you about to move to New York? Any, are you excited? You terrified?
Both. Yeah, you know, I got to start over. I set up a pretty good network here in Chicago. I'm pretty happy with what I've done in Chicago, and you know, I'm excited about the challenge of doing it all over again in a bigger place, in a more challenging place, in a place that, you know, the ceiling is much higher, you know, because all the people are there. That's where all the people are there, or Los Angeles, and so, you know... It's not like, it's no, every time you do something in Chicago, it's like, with an asterisk, yeah, but you're in Chicago. You're in New York and you do something, it's like, there's no asterisk. It's, you're doing that in New York.
Wow.
What?
That's interesting.
Is that no good?
I don't know. That's your perspective. I mean, you know, you're from here. You might be right. I guess if you're from here, I don't know.
So give me a counterpoint, because I'm not
saying that. I have lived in New York City twice, once like a dog and once like a rock star. Mm-hmm. It is a much better place to live with money. Of course, live there struggling is fucking really hard. I mean, because it's constant great shit that's in your face being advertised that you can't afford to go to.
Right, right.
So, I mean, it's great that you're doing it. It's great for development. I think once you get to a certain level as a comedian, it doesn't matter where you live. Unless you're trying to get the brass ring of film and television and stuff like that. But, you know, I think it's great you're doing it. I think Chicago... had a dry spell in comedy, and now it's on fire again. There's tons of clubs here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you're lucky you have this to fall back on, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I think you're right. It seems when you get to a certain point that, yeah, you can kind of live wherever you want or live, you know, nowhere or anywhere. But I'm just saying at this stage, at early stages of development, anytime I do something, if I have any success on any level, there's this other thing of like, yeah, but you're doing it out of Chicago.
Right.
Go do it out in New York, then there's nothing people can say about that. It's like, it's in New York. That's where, you know,
capital of the world.
Right.
Do you have any questions for me?
Questions for you? Oh, man. Put me on the spot here. Okay. Well, let's see here. Are you happy with where you are in life right now?
Yes, very much so. As a comedian, no. I want to come up with a whole new hour. And Stanhope and the way his business model, like, you know, he's talking about living wherever you want. He lives in Arizona.
Right.
He lives, like, wherever. But he's turning over a new hour special, like, every, year or two.
Yeah.
And then he'll tour constantly, heavily, and then he'll take like a month or two off.
Right.
And I have the best life imaginable.
Okay.
And I've, you know, been all over this year, the world, and
it sounds like at the least incredibly interesting.
Yeah, and then so the fact that I need to come up with a new hour is actually cool, because that's what it's all about. It's that's the whole joy is in writing jokes,
right,
and thinking of silly things. So
right.
It's a good problem to have. I mean, that's my only frustration. But other than that, yes, very.
That's
happy.
Pretty great. I mean, that's like, I feel like you, just by in that alone, you've, I mean, that's pretty awesome that you can even
I
say that.
I think the 14-year-old me, if he looked at the 46-year-old me, who I am now, would be really impressed.
Okay.
I think the 14-year-old me, seeing who I became, would be really happy.
It's super jazzed to like become
like, wow,
that.
Fuck, cool.
Yeah, we're going to be this
really?
Guy. Yeah.
That's your life?
Yeah.
My life?
Right, it's our life, right.
Yeah.
I think that's great. That goes back to the same idea. It's not just with comedy, but impress yourself. You know,
right.
You're doing that in life, and that's awesome. If you can go in retrospect and go, I would have loved to know that I was going to live this life at some point. I think that's great.
It's good. All right, brother. It's been great working with you. You know, I love what you're doing. Love the comedy thunderbolt you're throwing down.
Oh, thanks,
man. And look forward to seeing your star rise and shit, bro.
You bet. So, thanks for having me on the show.
In closing, do you have any words of wisdom or advice for the people of the earth?
Yeah, go to drewmichaelcomedy.com. I don't know.
It's as simple as that.
I say things sometimes, and I put them on there.
All right.
In various forms.
That's good advice. As good as any. All right. Shalom, amigo.